recently. Every member voted in support. The Bloomberg News Agency has more on the same story. A new opinion poll showed most Americans think former President Donald Trump should be forced to testify to a House committee investigating last year's assault on the U.S. Capitol, and they want the questioning to be conducted in public view. The Monmouth University survey also found that opinions about Donald Trump's involvement in the attack on the Capitol have not been significantly impacted by the televised public hearings the committee held from 9th of June to 21st of July. It also found the country is evenly split on whether they believe Donald Trump's continued presence in political life poses a danger to democracy. 47% of the American public say it does, and 50% say it doesn't. The opinion polls show 60% of those surveyed believe Trump should have to testify to the committee, while 34% believe he does not have to testify. If Trump does, 77% said, that should occur in a public hearing, not a private hearing or a private setting. The new Monmouth University poll findings also show that 36% of those surveyed now say Donald Trump is directly responsible for what happened at the Capitol. 27% feel that Donald Trump encouraged those involved but is not directly responsible. And 33% feel he has done nothing wrong regarding the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol. A June opinion poll done by Monmouth University found that 42% believed Trump was responsible for the attack, 25% believed he encouraged the attack, and 30% believed he had done nothing wrong. 45% of Americans now favor charging Trump with crimes related to his involvement in the incident, but another 38% are opposed to it. More Republicans have moved to opposing criminal charges, 79% now, up from 66% back in August. There is ample precedent for Congress to seek testimony from a former president. Over the past century and a half, at least six current and former presidents have testified on Capitol Hill, including John Tyler and Quincy Adams, after both were subpoenaed in 1848.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the fresh developments in the months-long hijab controversy in India, as well as blatant hypocrisy of some Indian celebrities on the route. And we shall also look at the U-turn by the Indian government on granting voting rights to non-local Kashmiris in Kashmir following widespread protests.
In yet another twist to the simmering hijab row in India, the country's apex court just recently delivered a split verdict on petitions challenging a provincial court verdict on the hijab ban in government schools. India's Supreme Court referred the matter to the Chief Justice for the constitution of a larger bench. It came exactly 7 months after a top court in southern India's Karnataka state upheld the hijab ban, dismissing pleas by Muslim students who demanded the right to wear hijab in classrooms.
A high-profile panel of judges at India's top court issued a split verdict on October 13th. One of the judges dismissed appeals challenging the order of the Karnataka High Court on the hijab ban in government schools in the BJP-ruled southern Indian state. Another judge said the Karnataka High Court has taken the wrong path, arguing that wearing a hijab is ultimately a matter of choice. Given the divergence of opinion, the matter has now been referred to the top judiciary official to set up a bigger bench. In December 2021, a government college in Karnataka's Udupi district barred Muslim students from joining classes wearing hijab. Subsequently, other colleges across the state also enforced the ban. In February, the right-wing government in the state issued an order banning Muslim students from wearing hijab in classrooms, sparking protests by students and their parents. The ban was in March upheld by the state's top court, which prompted some Muslim students to challenge the ruling in the Supreme Court. Critics have termed the hijab ban another move to marginalize the minority Muslim community in the Hindu-majority country. Muslims, who account for more than 15% of the country's 1.4 billion population, have faced numerous existential challenges since the BJP rose to power in 2014.
Many Indian film celebrities and prominent television journalists have been called out in recent weeks for displaying selective outrage and blatant hypocrisy by keeping silent over the hijab ban in India while issuing hysterical statements on foreign-backed anti-hijab protests turned riot in Iran. Priyanka Chopra, a Bollywood actress who has now moved to Hollywood, has in particular faced scathing criticism for condemning the recent death of a young woman in Iran while maintaining silence on the government-sanctioned ban on Muslim headscarves in her home country.
In recent weeks, the death of Mahsa Amini in Iran has laid bare blatant double standards of self-righteous celebrities, influencers, activists, and journalists across the world.
The death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini.
While they have allowed themselves to be swayed by Western propaganda mills dishing out misinformation on Iran, they have obdurately refused to comment or condemn the rampant abuse of human rights in other parts of the world. One such example is Priyanka Chopra, a leading Indian film star, now a big name in Hollywood. Last week in an Instagram post, Chopra told her 82 million followers that she was in awe of women protesting in faraway Iran. The post backfired badly, with many grilling her for keeping silent over the hijab ban in India and the relentless persecution of minority Muslims in her country. Foreign-backed rioters in Iran. One of them was India Today editor Geeta Mohan. Her publicity stunt proved counterproductive, as people wondered whether she would also wear hijab on air in solidarity with Muslim girls barred from wearing headscarves to schools in India.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Ahmed Hussain, spokesperson for the Muslim Public Affairs Committee in the UK. It's glad to see you, Mr. Hussain. Now, how do you view the Indian Supreme Court split verdict on the hijab controversy? And is it in favor of Muslim students who have challenged the ban or the right-wing government in Karnataka?
So this ruling was supposed to be conclusive between two judges from the Supreme Court, but however, it wasn't, because the two judges came to a loggerheads with opposing conclusions. One of the judges, Dulia, he was against Karnataka's initial ruling in the first place because he believes that this is an issue of personal choice, personal dress codes, how women want to dress. It's not something for the courts to wade in on. However, his peer, Gupta, believed that Karnataka's hijab ban ruling should stand. And very curiously, he used straw man arguments like the right to dress will include the right to undress also. But to answer your question, any ruling from the Supreme Court is going to be an interpretation of rights as laid down by India's constitution. So this means that the real question is India's constitution fit for purpose when it comes to safeguarding the rights of minorities like Muslims? And when I see recent laws around citizenship or recent amendments to the constitution itself regarding Kashmir, the answer has to be no.
Mr. Hussain, what about the Karnataka High Court, which in March upheld the government ban on wearing hijab in classrooms in the southern Indian state? Now, do you expect the Supreme Court's bigger bench to take a more holistic view?
So the debate could now be taken to a larger bench, and who would sit on that bench would be decided by the Chief Justice, Uday Umesh Lalit. Now, something that's worth remembering is that he himself was part of the five-judge bench who ruled the triple talaq unconstitutional in 2017. So he already has a track record of meddling in Muslims' affairs. And a key thing to remember is that Karnataka's government is made up of 25 BJP seats out of 28 since the 2019 election. And that's actually up from 17 seats in the 2014 election. Why do I mention that? It's because the BJP's propaganda is clearly very effective in Karnataka. And part and parcel of the BJP propaganda is a genocidal scapegoating of Muslims to hide their own failures. So I'm sorry to sound pessimistic, but if the Supreme Court's final ruling is not Islamophobic enough to the ears of BJP and RSS supporters, then they will whip themselves up into a frenzy on the streets of Karnataka. And it's not only in India we've seen this before, we've even seen something similar here on the streets of Britain.
Mr. Hussain, what about the Indian celebrities and journalists which have faced criticism for speaking on anti-hijab rights in Iran while keeping silent on the hijab ban in India? Doesn't this seem like a case of hypocrisy and double standards?
Yeah, whatever your view on the hijab itself, you can't claim to be against authoritarianism in one situation and be silent on the other. That's just hypocrisy. And if it's rooted in ignorance, then that celebrity or journalist needs to be embarrassed. But if it's rooted in some kind of political or religious bigotry, then that person needs to be shamed. Because women's rights should not be used by politicians or political movements for cheap political points.
Last but not least, Mr. Hussain, why don't Muslim girls fighting the draconian ban on hijab in India have enough voices supporting them, and why do Indian celebrities refrain from criticising their government?
Being a celebrity is about being popular. It's about being fickle enough to just go with the flow. And politics in India have made Muslims very unpopular. So it's really not surprising to see them supporting the regime's perspective on Muslims and Muslim issues. But the bigger problem here that we have with Muslims supporting Muslims, it's not just in India either. The big problem we have with the Muslim community is that we are like, you know, sheep looking out for a shepherd to look after us. What we do is we expect this shepherd to look after everything for us, to defend us, speak up for us, and so on. But what we forget is that every shepherd is just trying to grow his sheep and one day lead them to slaughter. We Muslims, we must not be sheep anymore. Our sisters in India are doing the brave and terrifying work of standing up to the Islamophobia of an entire country. The least we can do, we Muslim men and women around the world, is to speak up for them, be their voice, as well as elevating their own voice too.
There you have it, Mr. Ahmed Hussain, spokesperson for the Muslim Public Affairs Committee from the UK. It's always glad to have you with us, Mr. Hussain. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Former Pakistani diplomat Asif Durrani says West wants to take undue advantage of situation in Iran, asserting that if they are so concerned, they should give freedom of choice to Muslim women in France and India. Journalist and commentator Sayed Zafar Mehdi calls out hypocrisy of Indian celebrities such as Priyanka Chopra, who have the temerity to back anti-hijab protests in faraway Iran, but refrain from condemning the hijab ban in their own country.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The Indian government has scrapped the controversial rule granting voting rights to new residents of Jammu and Kashmir after a massive backlash in the Himalayan region, with local political parties dubbing it a bid to alter the contested region's demography. The rule was scrapped only 2 days after being introduced in one of the 20 districts in the region. It allowed Indian citizens living in Kashmir for a year or more to register as voters, replacing a rule that restricted the franchise only to permanent residents.
Following widespread anger and outrage, India's Hindu nationalist government on October 13th decided to scrap a contentious rule that granted voting rights to new residents in Jammu and Kashmir region. Local authorities said the measure, introduced just 2 days before, had been withdrawn and was to be treated as void without providing further details. It came 2 months after the Narendra Modi-led BJP government in New Delhi announced that around 2.5 million voters are expected to be added to the voter list in the region, which would increase the electorate by more than a third from 7.6 million presently. The announcement sparked angry and spontaneous protests in the Muslim-majority Himalayan region, with political parties unanimously denouncing the move, fearing demographic changes. In a tweet last week, the region's former chief minister, Mehbooba Mufti, accused New Delhi of creating religious and regional divisions in Kashmir, saying the attempts must be thwarted. She had previously described the move to allow non-locals to vote as the last nail in the coffin of electoral democracy in the region, equating the BJP government with Nazi Germany and Israel. Mufti's political rival and former chief minister, Omar Abdullah, also decried the move, accusing the BJP of importing voters to win power in Kashmir.
India stripped the disputed Himalayan region of its semi-autonomy in August 2019, reorganizing the erstwhile Jammu and Kashmir state into two federally administered territories. It also introduced changes in the constitution to allow non-locals to vote in the elections and buy properties in Kashmir. Before 2019, voting rights were limited to permanent residents only, guaranteed under Article 370 of the Indian Constitution. The law also barred Indians from outside Kashmir from permanently settling, buying land, and holding local government jobs in the region.
The decision to allow voting rights to non-local Kashmiris living temporarily in the region has ignited anger and fury in recent months, stoking fears of yet another attempt by the Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi to dilute the Muslim-majority region's demography. Among the new voters included Indian Army personnel, government and private sector employees, and migrant workers, as authorities had declared there was no need for an Indian citizen to have a domicile certificate or to be a permanent resident to get enlisted as a voter in the region. It was seen by local political parties and civil society groups as a cunning ploy to redraw the electoral map and change the region's demography. Since August 2019, when Kashmir's semi-autonomous status was abrogated, a series of laws have been introduced to allow the Hindu nationalist BJP to gain a foothold in the Muslim-majority region. As per the Indian government's last census in 2011, Kashmir had a total population of about 12.5 million, of which Muslims comprised 68.31% and Hindus 28.43%. Some pundits see the BJP government's decision to add non-locals to the voting list in the region as the final solution to the long-standing dispute, which has seen India and Pakistan go to war at least three times.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Zia Ahmed, the editor-in-chief of the Sri Lankan Muslim Times. Welcome to the program, Mr. Ahmed. Now, the Indian government has for now scrapped the rule that granted voting rights to non-local Kashmiris in Kashmir. Is this U-turn the result of growing anger and outrage in the region?
There is widespread anger amongst Kashmiris within the region, as well as in the Kashmiri diaspora spread all over the world, or Indian government's oppression of Kashmiris and violation of their human rights. Yes, this U-turn may be, due to the fact that the Hindu nationalist government has realized that they have crossed the red line, by granting voting rights to the non-Kashmiris in Kashmir. And this blatant move may inflame the situation further in the region. Moreover, the BJP government is also preparing for a number of state elections as well as the national election in 2024. And strategically, they may have thought to calm the situation down in Kashmir and elsewhere in the rest of India and against their criticism of minorities within India itself.
Mr. Ahmed, the popular opinion in the Himalayan region points to apprehensions amongst people that the Hindu nationalist government in India wants to change the region's demography. I want to see your assessment on this.
Moreover, the BJP government is also preparing for a number of state elections as well as the national election in 2024. And strategically, they may have thought to calm the situation down in Kashmir and elsewhere in the rest of India and against their criticism of minorities within India itself. Kashmir is a disputed region between India and Pakistan, and it was for the indigenous people of Kashmir to decide whether they wanted to stay within the Union of India or opt to merge with Pakistan in accordance with the United Nations Resolution in 1947. But unfortunately, on 27th of October, which is observed as a black day by the Kashmiris, since on this day, 75 years ago, India took control of state of Jammu and Kashmir militarily, with the promise of self-determination of Kashmir through a plebiscite of referendum. Now, it has been almost three quarters of a century that India has reneged on its promise for the legitimate rights of Kashmiris to hold a plebiscite and have their self-determination, whether they want to stay with India or to merge with Pakistan or even to stay independent. Now, India has been, over all these 75 years, did not hold this plebiscite or referendum. And now they have blatantly annexed Kashmir without any consultation. Now, India has occupied Kashmir with its iron fist of his military and gradually making moves to change the demography of this only Muslim majority state in the country by settling non-Kashmiris in Kashmir and eventually to dilute the indigenous religious, cultural and linguistic nature of the Kashmiris ethnic majority.
Last but not least, since August 2019, a series of measures have been taken by the BJP government in New Delhi to integrate Kashmir with the Indian Union. And now, how do you sense the mood in the region today?
So the Kashmiris have been seeking self-determination since 1947, which Indian government has not allowed in spite of the promises made through the United Nations. And now, blatantly in August 2019, the BJP government virtually annexed Kashmir with a large influx of military in the region, which was already the largest militarized region in the whole world. They put more military there, and they knew that there were going to be opposition by the Kashmiri people, but they basically shut everybody within their houses. And then, especially with the pandemic, COVID-19 coming in as well, they really oppressed the Kashmiris that they could not hold any rallies or show any opposition to the government's move. The mosques were closed, and they're closed now and then again. The freedom of movement, the freedom of expression, even educational institutions get closed now and then. So they are really completely shutting the the say and the wishes of the Kashmiri people and oppressing them. It is very similar to just like an occupying power, what the Israelis have done in Palestine, where they have completely took control of the indigenous people and violated their human rights and completely disregarded their rights of self-determination, just like Israelis have done to Palestinians. The same textbook copy is being perpetrated in the region of Kashmir as well. And of course, India and Israel collaborate with each other on these issues gradually and globally. If people want to understand, it's a very similar situation what is in Palestine with oppression by the Israelis. The Indian government is enacting the same kind of oppression in Kashmir as well. In addition to that, the BJP government is a Hindu nationalist government, and it wants to create a Hindu nation in India and eventually oppressing its minorities into submission. And even there is a danger that if these moves are not stopped, there might be a genocide of minorities, especially Muslims, in India. And India, Muslim population is very big. There are about 200 million Muslims out of, say, a billion Indians. It's not that easy to submit or wipe them out through genocide. What they will do is they will make the position of Muslims in India and especially in Kashmir unbearable, miserable, and very hard to live in India, and that is going to be a problem not only for India, but it's going to be a problem for the whole world if this kind of oppression is allowed to take place in India and especially in Kashmir.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Zia Ahmed, the editor-in-chief of the Sri Lankan Muslim Times. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Sayed Samer Abbas, a Pakistani journalist, says India was forced to withdraw the controversial law designed to change the demography of Kashmir, commending the efforts of the region's political leadership. Journalist Raisa Wickramatoon quotes from an article by Makhnoon Wani that the long-standing conflict in Kashmir cannot be brushed aside while making critical decisions about the territory. Arif Ayyub, a Mumbai-based activist, asserts that India has not helped its cause by scrapping Article 370, adding that Kashmir's demography is being mutilated to eradicate its Muslim majority status.
And that was our episode about the hijab ban in India and the hypocritical stance of Indian celebrities on the issue. And also, the Indian government's decision to scrap the rule allowing non-resident Kashmiris to vote in the region. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains,
closer. Iran.
Hello. I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. This Turkmen rug looks gorgeous. Great design. Actually, my today's destination is not the colorful, fantastic bazaars of Golestan province. I have made a trip to this province in order to visit a monument called Gumbad-e-Qabus, which is considered to be a masterpiece of Iranian architecture. This great monument is located in the city of Gumbad-e-Qabus. I promise this would be a perfect trip. Stay with me. Gumbad-e-Qabus Tower is a monument in the city of Gumbad-e-Qabus in Golestan province, northern Iran. It marks the grave of Ziyarid ruler Qabus and was built during his lifetime. It is a cylindrical tomb tower that reaches 72 meters and can be seen from some 30 kilometers away. The monument has an interior diameter of 9.67 meters at its base. The inscription bands on the tower, written in rhymed prose, states that Qabus ordered the foundation of the tower built during his lifetime. The tower is entirely constructed of fine quality baked bricks, which has been turned golden by the sun rays. The only decoration in the tower comprises two inscription bands which ring the building above the doorway and below the roof. Each band is divided into 10 panels, one set between each pair of buttresses. Though the tower is meant to be Qabus mausoleum, there is no body buried inside, similar to other tomb towers of northern Iran. This tower looks brilliant even from this distance.
This tower is actually the symbol of the city. It has universal reputation and is considered as a masterpiece of Iranian architecture.
Thanks for the information, sir.
Well, here we arrive. Have a nice tour.
Thank you. Well, I am now in a garden which has placed Gumbad Qaboos Tower. This tower is actually situated on a hill. A green, beautiful atmosphere. Very beautiful. You know, here I have an appointment with Mr. Rahmani, Professor of Architecture and History. I think I saw him, yes. There he is. Hello, sir. It's good to see you.
Hello. My pleasure.
What distinguishes this tower from other structures?
The only material used in this tower is baked brick and Saruj traditional water-resistant mortar. This tower has no cement, no metal frame, and no iron. The red baked bricks have been turned golden by the rays of sun.
Oh, great.
This tower is the only monument which survived the Mongol invasion.
Now, let me take a closer look at this tower. Gumbad Qaboos is established on a very firm foundation. It has survived even after strong earthquakes, and there is no sign of damage on the tower. Remarkable. Let me go inside. Well, it's simple, just like the outer part of the tower. No decoration. The factor of firmness is the most important thing that has been taken into consideration. Decoration and beauty have come second in the eyes of the architect. And outside the tower, there is a circular site, which there is something wonderful about it. If you come to this place, say something or sing a song, your voice will be echoed. Let me try it. Hello?
Hello?
Hello? Oh. Oh, everybody's watching. I feel so embarrassed.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
on the news line.
Twitter account of UN Human Rights Council addressed the report published by the three-member commission and shared the link to it. The title of the report very clearly addresses the occupation to be unlawful under international law with zero ambiguity. The report states the reason for the conclusion to be the permanence of the occupation as well as Israel's de facto annexation policies. Navi Pillai, chair of the commission, stated, "Recent statements by the Secretary General and numerous member states have clearly indicated that any attempt at unilateral annexation of a state's territory by another is a violation of international law and is null and void. 143 member states, including Israel, last week voted in favor of a General Assembly resolution reaffirming this." The chair also further added, "Unless universally applied, including to the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, this core principle of the United Nations Charter will become meaningless." The 28-page report published by Navanethem Pillai, Milun Kothari, and Christopher Sidoti highlights the sustenance and the advancement of the settlement enterprise, and the continuous expansion over the past couple of years that resulted in many Palestinian families to be forced out of their homes only for foreigners who've never been to the land to occupy their homes.
Yaakov, you know this is not your house.
Yes, but if I go, you don't go back. So what's the problem? What are you yelling at me? I didn't do this.
But you're
easy to yell at me, but I didn't do this.
Yeah, you are stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going
to
steal it.
No one is allowed to steal it, Yami.
Statements by Israeli officials that showed their intention to maintain permanent control over the expanding settlements were also noted in the reports and were part of the reason why the occupation was declared unlawful. Chair of the commission also recognized the direct and indirect transferring of Israelis into the settlements as a plan to ensure permanent Israeli control in the West Bank. The Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including Al-Quds and in Israel. That is the name that the UN gave to the commission in May of 2021 when the UN Human Rights Council held a special session on the grave human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territory. During the session, the UNHRC decided to establish an urgent international commission of inquiry to investigate alleged human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territories at the hands of Israel. The recent report is the culmination of what the three-member council has found during the past year and a half in what seems to be an uncharacteristically direct accusation of Israeli human rights violation and breaking of international law. Let's take a quick look at some of the bullet points mentioned in the report. An allusion to the core principles of the UN on annexation, which Israel seems to have also agreed to, even though it has violated it. The existence of a settlement enterprise and the efforts to make settlement permanent, violating the rights of Palestinians who were forced to leave as settlers took their homes by force. Israelis' exploitation of land and natural resources, the restrictive urban planning and zoning policies that sees Palestinian construction as an impediment to settlements that result in frequent confiscation of land, demolition of homes, and eventually displacement. The silent harm and psychological trauma resulting from erosion of economic, social, and cultural rights of Palestinians in a coercive environment that fragments the Palestinian society. The necessity of international action as Israeli government's actions are seen by the Commission as criminal, particularly its direct and indirect transfer of civilian population into occupied and annexed territories. The report seems to be a step in the right direction for the UN to fulfill its sole responsibility of standing up for human rights violations globally. But whether or not the criminal accusations towards Israel will lead to an International Court of Justice investigation and trial remains to be seen, especially when Israel has the unwavering support of the U.S.
Iran has doubled down on its earlier stance that it has not supplied weapons to Russia to be used against Ukraine. Foreign ministry officials say those claims are untrue and based on false information. Tehran says the accusations are part of a propaganda campaign by the West to stoke tensions with Iran. The accusations against Iran have been leveled by Ukraine and its Western backers. They say Russia has been using Iranian-made drones to strike Ukrainian cities in recent weeks. The Kremlin has also roundly denied the accusation, saying it's using Russia-made weapons in its strikes. Also, some Western media outlets have cited U.S. security officials as saying that more Iranian drones as well as missiles are to be shipped to Russia. But the Pentagon says it cannot confirm those reports. However, it says it will take steps to make the sale of Iranian drones harder. Ukraine has also threatened to cut diplomatic ties with Iran. But Tehran says it holds a neutral stance and believes dialogue is the best way to end the war. Iran has invariably stressed the need for respect for various countries' sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity, including Ukraine, based on the principles of the United Nations Charter.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has taken a clear and consistent position on the situation in Ukraine, which has been pronounced since the start of the conflict. The Islamic Republic of Iran has always emphasized that all UN members must fully respect the purpose and principles enshrined in the United Nations Charter as well as applicable international law.
The accusations against Iran come amid intensifying tensions at war fronts in Ukraine. Citizens and pro-Russian officials are evacuating from the main city in Kherson region just as Ukrainian forces are pushing to take back the area from Russia. Over 60,000 people will be evacuated within the next 6 days. The anti-Iran claims first emerged in July. Back then, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan alleged that Washington had received, quote, information indicating that Iran was preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred unmanned aerial vehicles, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline. Flying at low altitude, these unmanned aircraft can evade traditional air defense systems before dive bombing their targets. The distinctive delta wing design of the drones has led Ukrainian and Western officials to claim that they are Iranian Shahed 136 UAVs. Russia's use of the so-called kamikaze drones has sparked panic in Ukraine. The United States, Britain and France were planning to raise the claim during a closed-door UN Security Council meeting. They accuse Iran of violating a UN Security Council resolution that had placed an arms embargo on Iran. The arms embargo expired in 2020, despite the efforts of former US President Donald Trump to renew it.
Iran categorically rejected unfounded and unsubstantiated claims that Iran has transferred UAVs for the use of the conflict in Ukraine. It is recently disappointing that to pursue their political agenda, these states are trying to launch a disinformation campaign against Iran.
So, dear colleagues, today we have observed another round of the disinformation campaign from the Security Council by the Western delegations, as they raised in the Council the issue of the UAVs allegedly used by Russia in Ukraine. The aim of our Western colleagues is clear. They attempt to hit two targets at once, inventing an artificial pretext to put pressure on Russia and on Iran.
The accusations come amid continued NATO military support for Ukraine. The West is now under fire for fanning the flames of war by sending more and more military hardware there. It's now believed that the accusations made against Iran are part of a larger media campaign against the Islamic Republic. the West, led by the United States, were trying to pressurize Iran by supporting the rioters in Iran during the recent tensions. They imposed a series of sanctions on Iranian officials over human rights allegations. However, they failed to dictate their will on Iran.
France is facing protests over the cost of living crisis fueled by soaring inflation. Police have clashed with the protesters, venting anger in the capital, Paris. Protesters were met with police brutality. Police used batons to disperse the protesters, who were throwing rocks at security forces. There are calls by trade unions for a nationwide transport strike. Unions now say it is time to expand the industrial action at oil refineries to other sectors. Protesters and strikers say they need pay rise to cope with the soaring cost of living. France is now experiencing inflation at 6.2%. That is the highest rate in decades. Striking workers are demanding higher wages from the profits of energy companies amid high oil and gas prices. Protesters have demanded emergency measures against high prices, including freezes in the cost of energy. The industrial action has taken offline more than 60% of France's refining capacity. Macron's government is also on the defensive in Parliament, where it has lost its majority in legislative elections in June. It is much more difficult for his centrist alliance to implement his agenda against strengthened opponents. France is not the only country in Europe that is facing protests. European countries are facing more strikes and protests due to high energy prices and the mounting cost of living. The UK economy shrank by 0.3% in August. It experienced a 10.2% inflation rate in September, which was the highest in 40 years. The latest data shows that inflation rose on average to 10.9% across the European Union. Europe faces a very difficult economic climate if the current energy crisis worsens, with winter temperatures likely to be a decisive factor.
The European Union has imposed sanctions on Iran over its response to recent riots in the country. The sanctions list includes 11 individuals and 4 entities and targets a section of Iran's police, the Basij Volunteer Forces, and the cyber division of the country's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The Iranian Information Minister is also blacklisted. The coercive measures include travel bans and asset freezes. The sanctions were imposed during a meeting of EU foreign ministers. The move drew strong condemnation from Tehran, with the Iranian Foreign Ministry promising reciprocal bans on European officials and entities.
The Islamic Republic of Iran will make a reciprocal and proportionate reaction.
Iran's foreign ministry has described the EU sanctions as a violation of international law and a clear example of meddling in the country's internal affairs. The ministry also accused the bloc of bias and using human rights as a means to achieve political goals. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian also took to Twitter to dismiss the sanctions as futile and based on false allegations.
Down a well-worn path of ineffective sanctions, the EU today adopted further superfluous sanctions on Iranian persons. It is an unconstructive act out of miscalculation based on widespread disinformation. Riots and vandalism are not tolerated anywhere. Iran is no exception.
The EU and its member states had already acquired a reputation as major violators of human rights in Iran due to their inaction and endorsement of harsh US sanctions on the country. In the statement, the EU condemned what it called the widespread and disproportionate use of force against peaceful protesters in Iran. The EU foreign ministers accused the Iranian police of being responsible for Mahsa Amini's death, claiming she was beaten and mistreated. That's while a forensic investigation dismissed allegations that she was beaten and attributed her death to an underlying condition. The EU has intentionally disregarded and dismissed documents offered by Iran proving foreign support for the riots and showing that accusations leveled against the government are baseless. The U.S. US, Canada, and the UK leveled new sanctions against Iranian authorities and entities in response to the recent unrest in Iran, and the EU followed suit. These countries say Iranians' right to peacefully protest must be ensured under any circumstances. But as Iran's foreign minister has described it, these nations have considered riots and terrorist actions as protests in interventionist comments, which in effect incite rioters and terrorists.
We need to separate the riots from peaceful demonstration. Anyone in their right state of mind will understand the difference between these two and separate them. The reality is people do have legitimate right everywhere in the world. Indeed, in Iran, it's part of the Iranian constitution. They have the right to demonstrate, but no one has got the right to commit riots and endanger people's lives.
Meanwhile, there have been plenty of instances of the Western government's widespread violations of human rights and suppression of peaceful protests in their own countries, particularly in the EU. Serious human rights violations, including corruption, human trafficking, racism, and discrimination, persist across Europe, while unemployment and poverty in many countries are nurturing extremism and conflict. Therefore, Iranian officials say the EU cannot impose sanctions on Iran as long as countries within the bloc are violating human rights.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
After more than a year has passed since U.S. President Joe Biden took office, the reality we're witnessing is the continuation of former U.S. President Donald Trump's most aggressive immigration policies towards immigrants. The Biden administration not only cannot fulfill its promises that it has given to immigrants, but also insists on racist, xenophobic, and repressive views against immigration. The treatment of illegal immigrants in U.S. violates human rights in many cases, and the number of those who enter this country through the Mexican border and are victims of physical and mental abuse is not small. For example, the U.S. Republican Party, by abusing the immigrants and transferring them to the regions under the leadership of Democrats, is trying to take political advantage of this measure and put more pressure on the Biden administration. We have taken a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has written, some migrants who were flown to the island of Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts said on Thursday, 15th of September, they were duped about their destination, and Democratic leaders called for a probe of the move by Florida's Republican governor to send them there from Texas. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who's up for re-election this November and seen as a possible presidential contender in 2024, took credit for the two flights, which originated in San Antonio, Texas, and stopped in Florida on their way to Martha's Vineyard. The White House and residents of the vacation enclave called it a political stunt, as Ron DeSantis joins Republican governors from Texas and Arizona in sending migrants north. The governors have sought to highlight the two parties' differences on immigration policy and shift the burden of caring for immigrants to Democratic areas. For months, Texas and Arizona have sent busloads of migrants to the Democratic-run cities of New York, Chicago, and Washington. A Martha's Vineyard airport official said the two flights on Wednesday
14th of September, carried about 50 migrants, mostly from Venezuela. Hours after the